Welcome to Sci-Fi On Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo. And in this week's episode, we're going to be taking a look at Ridley Scott's 1982 film, Blade Runner. Like 2001 A Space Odyssey, which I podcasted a few weeks ago, there isn't much that has not been said about Blade Runner. There's a few little factoids in the production of it, which I've dug up. But for the most part, I'm going to be keeping it pretty personal and just kind of laying out my ideas and what I like in the film, what I don't think works that well. So let's start with a little background. As has been widely known, the film is based on a Philip K. Dick novel that he wrote in 1968 called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? The production history since the novel was published, actually, strangely enough, Martin Scorsese was briefly interested in doing a version in the early 70s, but he actually never optioned the screen rights. And in 1977, a guy named Hampton Fancher wrote a script based on the book that was optioned by a production company. Ridley Scott at the time was briefly attached to the Dune film, which then died, and he left that project. And actually, I didn't know, his elder brother, Frank Scott, died of skin cancer in 1980. And Ridley also lost his brother, Tony Scott, a couple of years back to suicide. From what I can tell, Wikipedia being my source, I won't kid anybody. Ridley wanted a project to kind of distract him from Frank's death. This is a funny thing that I found out. In terms of the title Blade Runner, up until that point, you know, it was basically the bizarro title that Dick had given the novel, and that was the title of the project. William Burroughs wrote a screenplay for a novel written by a guy named Alan E. Norse. The novel was called Blade Runner, and it was all one word. The production team and Ridley Scott, you know, like the name Blade Runner so much, they basically bought the script and all the rights to it, trashed it, and just kept the name. And the novel this guy Alan Norse wrote has nothing to do with anything that Dick's novel has to do with. Completely different. But so that's where the name comes from. It's completely artificial. Dick didn't come up with it. It's not in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. It's this bizarre sort of addition as the production was rolling on. So kind of an interesting thing. So then Scott, the idea, from what I'm guessing, is that Hampton Fancher wrote a book that was more based on sort of ecological issues, which I guess Dick's novel is based on. I read it, but I, like most Dick novels, I don't remember it that well, and didn't seem to be a very movie-ish, character-driven thing, from what I can tell. So they hired a guy named David Webb Peebles to do a rewrite on the script. I think Fancher came back later on to do some edits here and there. So they kind of were both working on it. And this guy, David Webb Peebles, you will know because he co-wrote 12 Monkeys, I believe, with his wife. And he wrote the film Unforgiven, which is now a classic that Clint Eastwood did. Philip K. Dick died just before the film was released, but they had sent him some test footage. This guy, Douglas Trumbull, who I believe worked on 2001 and a lot of sci-fi films in the 70s. Trumbull sent Dick some of the initial effect shots that were going to be used, and Dick supposedly really loved it, saying at one point that this is exactly how he had envisioned the world, that he was seeing what was in his mind. So kind of cool. So definitely Dick gave it his visual blessing at the very least. Not sure how he felt about the screenplay, but he did think that they really had gotten what his world looked like very well. So that's the production, and then the film was released in 1982. A word on versions of this film. This is a strange thing that I came across as I was watching it and reading about it. So in 1982, there was a theatrical release, 116 minutes long, and it contained sort of film noir voiceovers done by Harrison Ford. So he was narrating parts of the film because the distributing company didn't think that what was happening was being explained well enough. So they got Harrison to come back and do all these voiceover overdubs. They also tacked on this happy ending, which is basically, if anyone's seen it, it's Deckard and Rachel in this car out in the country somewhere. And, you know, there's this notion that she's going to live indefinitely, that she wasn't built with a four-year lifespan, and they're going to be happy ever after. There was no unicorn sequence whatsoever and no allusion to Deckard being a replicant. Then they released the same year, 82, this international version. And they added, I guess, some violent scenes that were edited out of the American release. So then in 1986, there was the broadcast edition, which usually is, you know, they Baudelaireize it for TV. And then the work print of the film, which I guess, you know, a work print which Scott had worked on before, I guess the studio had done a final edit, was shown to some audiences in 1992. They called it the director's cut, but you know, it really wasn't, just a work print. There was a really positive reaction to the screening. So the studio decided to kind of get moving on, like an official director's cut to restore the film. In that year, that work print sort of morphed into the director's cut. And what they did was they removed all of the voiceover narration. They inserted this unicorn dream sequence, which is the first anyone had seen of it. And they removed the happy ending. I think the last shot was just Deckard and Rachel getting into the elevator. However, supposedly Ridley Scott wasn't involved in that very much. He kind of disavowed it. So then in 1997 was the final cut, which is what I'm reviewing today, which I have gotten on Blu-ray. Basically, the director's cut, and they put more of the extreme violence back in. And the unicorn scene, when Deckard has this vision of a unicorn in the forest, is a little more expansive. It's like the full sequence. I guess it was cut briefly for the work print and the director's cut. So that's all the scuttlebutt and backstory for Blade Runner. So with that dispensed with, let's get into the analysis. So the film opens with this wonderful Vangelis score, and Vangelis has a long Greek name, which I didn't bother to look up for this podcast, but he was a big deal in soundtracks and scores in the 70s and 80s, and you go on to Wikipedia page, Chariots of Fire, I believe, was him. So he has done the score for this film, and we get this haunting, beautiful soundtrack, and we get some title cards that set up the film, and I'll read the title cards. So, quote, early in the 21st century, the Tyrell Corporation advanced robot evolution into the Nexus phase, a being virtually identical to a human known as a replicant. The Nexus 6 replicant were superior in strength and agility and at least equal in intelligence to the genetic engineers who created them. Replicants were used off-world as slave labor in the hazardous exploration and colonization of other planets. After a bloody mutiny by a Nexus 6 combat team in an off-world colony, replicants were declared illegal on Earth under penalty of death. Special police squads, Blade Runner units, had orders to shoot to kill upon detection of any trespassing replicant. This was not called execution, it was called retirement. End quote. So then we have a brief title card that comes up November 2017, and then we're into the first shot of this film, which is this beautiful vista of a future Los Angeles, dotted with these oil refineries that are flaming off excess gas, and we see a flying car pass underneath. They call these flying cars spinners in the film. These wonderful lens flares happen whenever the cars go by. And it's just beautiful as this film will continue to dazzle us scene by scene with exquisitely shot beauty in all areas, frankly. So we're moving through this vista, and we close in on this incredible pyramid-like structure, which is the Tyrell Corporation headquarters. And it's almost as if it's eight skyscrapers leaning inward towards each other, and then there's a sort of a pyramidal shape underneath it. It's beautiful. And this is a model. We're in pre-CGI land, and this is a wonderful model. And, you know, the thing with models, you can really tell, as in the Star Trek, the motion picture I reviewed a ways back, you know, the close-ups into models, when the camera gets really close, it really looks like it's there, because in fact that it is there. And there's something about the optics of such a thing that haven't been completely mimicked yet. So it's a really cool scene. So now we move into our first sequence. In the Tyrell Corporation, we're in this wonderfully, you know, lit, smoky interior. Looks like a couple of cubicles side by side, large spaces, sort of interview rooms. We've got ceiling fans, and one of the gentlemen is smoking. The thing with Blade Runner is what Ridley did with Alien really well, and he knows that you need to ground your speculative world in, you know, realism as much as possible. And so we're in this real grimy, kind of shabby cubicle interview area, and there's much more of that to come, but this is the beginning of it. We see a gentleman there sitting down across from the interviewer. His name is Leon. He's taking something called a void comp test, and we'll hear more about them as we go. What he's told is that it measures the emotional blush response, which I think is a real thing. You can go look it up. And he's being asked questions that trigger his emotions. Like most of the dialogue in this film, it doesn't flow easily. It doesn't flow well. It doesn't seem very naturalistic. It's very odd. So he asks Leon a few questions, and they're kind of cool questions in a way. If he was walking in a desert and picked up a turtle, what would he do? And then he begins to ask Leon about his mother. Leon discharges a firearm underneath the table, killing the man. And it's a really bad action sequence because the first shot hits the guy under the table, turns the seat around, and the chair repels sort of back, is propelled back into the wall, and like crashes into the wall. And then Leon stands up and actually raises the gun and shoots again. And when the bullet hits him, you know, the chair itself is launched backwards. It makes absolutely no sense that, you know, these look like regular firearms with bullets, that when you shoot someone, they would, you know, it would propel the person away from the bullet. It's ridiculous. So there's something with the physics about how this is done. It's very jarring, and it's really weird after so much of the wonderful realism we're getting. Yeah, I never really thought this scene worked very well. So now we're getting some more external shots of downtown Los Angeles, and it's incredible. I mean, there's this wonderful, we see in many shots of this film, this sort of LED, you know, as of this Times Square sort of jumbotron with these, you know, always Japanese themed advertisements as a woman like eating some kind of candy and Coca-Cola. Beautiful. And then a low angle shot of what looks like an airship, shaped kind of like a football, moving very slowly. And we're hearing dialogue about, you know, life on off-world colonies. So we're getting kind of a nice sci-fi throwaway line that, you know, Earth is not alone. Earth is sort of now part of a web of a colonial confederation, if you will. The only thing with me in this moment is flying cars. Now, I understand flying cars if they're going to use, you know, fans, as if they use, like they use on vertical takeoff jets, right? They direct the jet flow downward to push the craft up, and then the jet slowly, you know, takes on horizontal flight. These cars just look like, which is, I think, is the bane of any kind of sci-fi realism, anti-gravity, right? They look like they use some kind of anti-gravity. And if you had anti-gravity, I mean, as much as we know about physics now, if there was such a thing as anti-gravity, it would revolutionize life to such a degree that it would be almost unrecognizable because of the power that humanity would have. And, you know, to have anti-gravity cars, I don't know, it always struck me as sort of like, it's a little nit for me, because the flying cars look cool and they're shot so well that it's nice to see them there. And I recognize that the scene, I think, needs them. This air movement of these vehicles in the air really makes the scene look futuristic, and Lucas has stolen from it incredibly with his Coruscant shots and all the Star Wars prequels, you know. So anyway, that's just a brief nit. But all of the shots of this futuristic Los Angeles are just unbelievable. It's some of the most beautiful production design that's really ever been done. But now we're taken down to the street level. And now it's a whole different story. Now we're getting into Ridley's gritty wonderfulness, where we're on this street and it's filled with people and it's raining and there's steam coming out from vents everywhere. There's this neon sign that's blinking on and off, and basically center on this one little area where there's a noodle stall, and pedestrians are walking around with umbrellas with the shaft of the umbrella glows. So you've got this otherworldly kind of futuristic looking thing. And it's our first scene with Deckard, and played by Harrison Ford, obviously. And he's standing on the side of the street waiting for a spot to open up in this noodle stall. And it's the noodle stall itself, too. I mean, it looks like, you know, it's documentary film. The realism of all this stuff, it's so beautifully shot. I mean, the lighting and just the depth of it all, and how gritty and real all of it is, down to a very, very minuscule level. It's incredible scene design and art design. We have Deckard sitting at the stall, and he's eating his lunch. And then another detective by the name of Gaff, played by Edward James Olmos, speaking something in Japanese. The guy at the noodle stall has to translate. And the notion is that the guy named Captain Bryant wants to see Deckard. So Deckard heads back to Gaff's car, and they sort of fly towards the police station. And you get these nice technical effects inside the cockpit of the spinner as it ascends, you know, effects that we've seen in 2001 and also in Alien, you know, of computer screens and grids and distance markers and numbers that are changing. Like, and it's all very cool. It weathers pretty well. I mean, I realize how high-tech computers are now, but the grittiness of it still, and it works in this film. So again, you know, on there's more flyby sequences. There's more of the city, more Vangelis soundtrack as it swells. You know, we're getting more of a vista. The police station itself is in this kind of vaulted cavernous room. It's almost like, you know, a police station in Grand Central Station here in New York City. It's beautiful, you know, and they get the whole lighting coming through the tall windows. It's you know, there's dust in the air, so everything's refracted and beautifully lit. But then at the far end of it is this little shack, which is the police station, and this police captain named Bryant is there. You know, basically the gist of the scene is that Bryant needs Deckard to sort of hunt for some, you know, replicants that were described in the opening crawl, and Deckard refuses, but Bryant threatens him, and the dialogue between the two of them is really bad, actually. It's really like cut-rate film noir dialogue. Deckard saying things like, I was quit when I came in here, I'm twice as quit now, and Bryant saying things like, remember, pal, if you're not cop, you're little people. It's just bad, and it's delivered badly. And like most of the dialogue in this film, you know, you have to kind of cringe to get past it. So the next sequence is Deckard quickly accepts the gig, and now he's got to be briefed on who he's going after. So we get a little exposition about a group of combat replicants who jumped the shuttle, killed passengers, and came back to Earth and dumped the shuttle off the coast of Los Angeles. And we hear that the previous evening or evenings, they tried to infiltrate the Tyrell Corporation. Two of the six were killed. And then we find out that the test that was done at the beginning of the film was done because Tyrell figured after that attack that some of them would try to infiltrate his company, posing as workers, and of course they did find Leon, who was one of the four. And then we get these brief video sort of mugshots of all of them, and we see Leon again, and we see Roy Batty, who's the leader, played by Rutger Hauer. We see a woman named Zora, played by Joanna Cassidy, and then there's Pris, you know, dubbed the pleasure model, played by Daryl Hannah. And we get these brief asides from Bryant. Like Bryant says, Zora, talk about Beauty and the Beast. She's both. It's abysmally bad dialogue. So what we're told is that they were built to resemble human beings in every way except emotions. But their designers postulated that after several years of living, the models might develop their own emotional responses. And so a four-year lifespan was built in to limit them from the ideas of they're getting their own emotions, they're bringing their own memories. They'll just bail, and they'll be you'll be unable to control them. They'll grow into autonomous life forms, which the corporation does not want, since they're usually designed for specific purposes. So the first task, Bryant wants Deckard to take the void comp machinery over to the Tyrell Corporation. He's told that there is a replicant there, the Nexus 6 model, and to make sure that the machine can detect the replicants. And so the briefing scene ends. So again, some nice LA exterior shots as Deckard flies over to Tyrell Corporation. More Vangelis, wonderful soundtrack. Then we get the interior of Tyrell Corporation, and it seems to be some vast office space, like a big executive space, and it is so beautiful. There are these columns in the space, and there's the backdrop of the sun setting on another Tyrell structure just next to the one that they're in. It's about as sci-fi a shot as you could. There's this wonderful flare by the setting sun. It's a beautiful shot. And we're introduced to Rachel, who works for Tyrell Corporation, played by Sean Young. And the strange-looking Tyrell himself, who's played by this older actor, he has these enormous glasses with like several layers of, you know, several lines going through them as if different focal lengths. He's a very cool, odd-looking guy. Tyrell tells Deckard, I want you to try the void contest on a human first. I want to see a negative before a positive. Please test it on Rachel. So they have this scene, the lights are very low, and Rachel's smoking, and Deckard's asking her all these questions, and I mean, it's beautiful, beautiful, the smoke coming off the cigarette is beautiful, and you know, you're getting some shots over Rachel's shoulder, and just gorgeous looking scene. After the void contest is finished, Tyrell asks Rachel to step outside, and the reveal is that Rachel is a replicant, but she hasn't been told. And Tyrell tells Deckard that she's an experiment and that she's been given artificial memories to see what that would do for her. And the idea is that, you know, when replicants in the real world start developing their own emotional responses, the lack of memory about who they are and what they are makes them very difficult to control, and it's very difficult for them. And that the experiment is to give replicants memories would allow their emotional responses, you know, to be dealt with in an easier fashion. There would be some sense of a self underneath them just being these units. And so Tyrell's kind of messing around with it. So the next sequence, we see Deckard in his spinner car flying, and we hear the interview that Leon briefly was giving when he was taking the Void comp test. The guy had asked him his address. And so, you know, the audience is being told that this is how Deckard knows where Leon lives. And so Deckard goes to Leon's apartment. It's an amazing apartment in terms of its green, grimy and dingy, but it's shot in such a luscious style. There's something that Ridley and his cinematographer do in this movie that's, it doesn't matter what they shoot, it looks insanely good. And it's like ruin porn. I don't know what it is. It's like grime porn. But every shot, it's an old brick-style hotel, so you're seeing like plaster and wallpaper, and it's just dingy and gross-looking. And yet, because of the way it's shot, it reminded me very much of a lot of the interiors of the Matrix buildings, like when the Matrix people would go and, you know, visit the Oracle, or they'd go to some building, really reminded me of the way they shot, especially this apartment. In Leon's bathtub, Deckard finds some blood and an odd-looking scale, which he takes as a sample, and he also finds a package full of photographs as well. And since Gaff, played by Edward James Olmos, is with him as a driver, he leaves his first origami man. Gaff's character, he wherever he goes, he kind of leaves these origami figures. I think he left one in the Bryant's office when Deckard was first there, of a little turkey, and now he leaves an origami stick man figure there. I don't know, just a cool, odd little touch in this film. And Gaff looks really neat. He's got this you know, steel-tipped cane, and he's dressed kind of like with a Van Dyke beard and these weird-looking eyes. Like, he's a very cool-looking character. So now we meet Roy Batty with Leon, and Leon's kind of, we're out on a city street. Leon's telling Roy that he wanted to go back for his photographs, but cops were there. And the camera pans over, and there's this really cool scene of these score of, like, bicycling people. With these Japanese-style peasant hats, and they bicycle in and around all these fires that are lit on the street for people to keep warm in. It's just, it's a cool little uncanny moment I really like. Roy and Leon basically visit a guy who, he's a genetic designer, but all he does is make eyes. And he's in this bizarre lab where the lab itself is ice cold, so he's wearing this huge suit that's fed by tubes, and he's got these wacky contraptions around his eyes, and it's just, it's a very uncanny, bizarre laboratory, and you see eyeballs floating in these containers. And so Batty walks in, and he has this wonderful quote, and the quote is, quote, "Fiery the angels fell, deep thunder rolled around their shoulders, burning with the fires of Orc." It's actually a deliberate misquoting of a William Blake poem, or a section of a Blake's poem, America, a Prophecy. And that quote is, "Fiery the angels rose. As they rose, deep thunder rolled around their shores, indignant, burning with the fires of Orc," etc., etc. So this is a deliberate misquotement, and it's possible that Batty is misquoting on purpose because there's nothing angelic about the replicants. They're not on some ascent. You know, they've fallen quite far in some of the things that they've done and will continue to do. So it's kind of neat. And Batty, and I should say, Howard doing the speech, very magnetic, you know, as he is in almost all of his scenes. He's an incredible presence in this film and really gives it a solid antagonist to kind of exist around. We see Leon put his hand in this some of the Sub-Zero liquid, pulling out some of the eyes, and they're threatening this guy, wanting to know about their what they call incept dates, which is when they were created and kind of turned on. So they tear this guy's coat off and threaten him. And basically, Batty gets the information that Tyrell's probably the only guy who can really help him with longevity. And he's got to see a guy named J.F. Sebastian, who is a genetic designer, who could probably get him in to see Tyrell. So now we have this wonderful scene between Deckard and Rachel. And we see Deckard coming home to his apartment. And he lives on the 97th floor. And we're getting now, you know, another sort of way of looking at L.A. as this sort of vertiginous city. It's incredibly high up where he lives, but the building itself is old and run down, and yet it has pretty high-tech elevators and video systems as well. Again, a wonderful mix of the high and low. Inside the elevator, when Deckard is about to get out, Rachel is there, and she's hiding in the corner. So Deckard brings her into his apartment. Again, Deckard's apartment, again, beautifully shot. He doesn't put the lights on, so most of the apartment is shadowed in darkness, but you're getting light coming sort of on and off from the external, from outside. You know, the light flickers a lot in long flickers because of cars or other things moving in front of it. So, and we hear, you know, cars at his level as well. going by outside. It's just an amazing setup. So Rachel is there basically to prove him wrong, kind of accusing him, have you ever used the test yourself? And Deckard begins quoting from her memory, basically things that she probably has never told another human being. And it's a really beautiful scene at this point. She starts to cry. And Vangelis has a special theme for this scene. In a sense, Rachel's being told that her entire life is a creation, and probably the memories of Tyrell's niece, as Deckard puts it, not her memories. You know, she cries, and the Vangelis music comes up, and it's, you know, they really achieve something here. It's a really, some definite pathos in this scene, and Deckard first being kind of harsh and cold that she's a replicant, he kind of softens as he sees her reaction. He kind of takes pity on her, and she turns to leave and kind of, you know, and so she kind of takes off out of the apartment, embarrassed to be there in front of him. So he winds up sorting through Leon's photographs, looking for a clue. We have this great shot of him with a drink out on his balcony. And again, he's all the way near the top of the building, and we see how far up he is and what LA looks like. And it's just, you know, so full of these, you know, block after block of immensely tall 100-plus story buildings. And yet, we don't see any sky. He's 97 stories up, but there's still more above him that blocks the sun. And it's amazing, amazing sequence. So now we see Pris, played by Daryl Hannah, hide herself in sort of the garbage of a side of a street. Again, you know, it's incredibly grimy in this alley. We've got this high-tech concept, right? And we got a lot of high-tech above. But on the street, man, it's all grime and gross and more rain. She is strategically placing herself there because she knows this is the entrance to J.F. Sebastian's home. And so she's going to play on her waif-like looks and demeanor to see if she can ingratiate herself to get into his apartment. And she does, in a way that's fairly believable. And the building that he lives in is very creepy. I think it's called the Bradbury, which possibly is a nod to Ray Bradbury. I'm not sure. But he's the only occupant of this huge apartment building. And we get a sense at this point that Earth is really the backwater, that the colony is an off-world, or really the places to be in this futuristic world, and that anyone who's anyone has gotten the hell out of L.A., and there's absolutely no housing shortage whatsoever. And yet, the streets are constantly packed with people. It's an odd kind of dichotomy in that way. But there's a beautiful shot as the elevator ascends up. The light from the elevator kind of moves with it and stabs out of the elevator shaft. It's just, my God, how beautiful it is. As they enter his apartment, he has created other replicants, but they're sort of toys. So they're little people and these odd kind of toy-like beings that seem, you know, that are kind of humanoid. These two little small Napoleonic people come up and say, well, hello, JF. And they're very, it's very weird. Everything in his apartment is very weird. And it's another uncanny thing in this film. It really gives it just an extra dimension, which is so cool to look at. So now we cut back to Deckard's apartment, and he's sitting by the piano, and he has this vision, a waking vision of a unicorn running through a forest. It's a beautiful shot, a beautiful unicorn. I mean, it's an amazing shot in itself. We have no idea at this point in the film what that is. We see him having it as a waking dream. And then after that, he takes one of Leon's photos, and he puts it in a machine, and he sits back with a drink in his hand. And again, his apartment is another great. It's just incredibly, the art direction here is ridiculously good. It just looks such a lived-in place, and lived in by a detective who's probably not home most of the time. Again, while he's sitting there, the light that's coming into his apartment, you know, obscures, then brightens because there are things going by outside, just making it incredibly realistic. And basically what he does is he thought he had noticed something in the photograph. So he puts it in this machine and he gives it these verbal cues, you know, pull back, left, focus on this section and that section. And he continues to look, and finally he finds that by focusing in on a mirror, he can see another figure in the apartment that wasn't visible, you know, if you just looked at the photograph by itself. It's a really cool shot, like how he finds it, and it's really well done. The effects are terrific. And we see a woman lying down in the back room of the apartment through this mirror, and he gets a photograph of it, and basically now he's out detecting. So he takes this scale that he picked up from Leon's apartment, and he brings it to a tech on the side of the street who's just another old Asian man, who gives him the maker of the snake. It was a sort of, it's made, it's an artificial snake. And we see as he's scanning it, you know, the little ID code tattooed on it, which is kind of cool. The woman pinpoints, oh, it's so-and-so and his shop is down the street, whatever. So Deckard basically enters the guy's shop and kind of strong arms him, and we get a location of, you know, where this person might be who he made it for, and it's a nightclub in Chinatown. So now we get this next sequence takes place in this incredible nightclub where just, you know, the costume design, the set design, it's just amazing. You know, you could write a book on this nightclub scene in itself. It's amazing. And Deckard enters and sits at the bar, and he winds up talking to the owner of the place, and he tries to intimidate the guy into telling him, you know, who owns the snake. And the guy basically, you know, tells him to fuck off and gives him a drink on the house. Then suddenly we hear from the back of the place that there'll be a performer who's going to be on stage with a snake. And of course, we know that this must be her. And we don't see the performance, which is kind of strange. We cut to afterwards. Deckard's kind of hanging around the dressing room area, and we see the woman who performs with the snake kind of come walking by. And Deckard sort of poses as this fast-talking, kind of mealy-mouthed guy who's there from, like, public affairs. And it's a terrible sequence where he kind of puts on a voice like this, ah, gee, miss. And he kind of goes into this character. And, you know, Harrison Ford is Harrison Ford, man. He doesn't do character. He doesn't do funny voices and goofy character actor moments like that. Like, he's Harrison Ford, you know, and it comes off awfully. And even she turns to him at one point. She's like, are you for real? And the audience, you know, we're kind of thinking the same thing. Like, is this scene for real? It's dumb. It's incredibly dumb. But the actress who plays Zora is terrific, Joanna Cassidy. She definitely can hold her own with Ford in the scenes, and it's a shame that Ford has to do these horrible, goofy caricatures that he was, you know, that are written into the script. Because I don't know, it was definitely chemistry between them in terms of, you know, they're both being powerful screen presences. So he's yakking away while she showers and gets dressed and everything, and basically she comes back out and she realizes that he must be a cop and like punches him and knocks him down and is about to strangle him, and someone enters the room, and so she bails and runs away. And so there's a brief chase out in the night. She's wearing this strange outfit where there's like a bustier that's over her shoulders and her breasts, and then she's wearing a completely kind of vinyl see-through plastic jacket around it. It's really weird looking. So there's a brief scene, you know, through all the buses and the people bustling around where she's hiding from him and he doesn't see her. And the sound design is just amazing. What's going on out on the street and how it's rendered in the sound design is just incredible. However bad this film is written, and it's written horribly, the sound design and the cinematography, it's so well mounted as a film that confirms my belief that, you know, film is primarily a visual medium and you can fuck up royally. With writing and somewhat with acting, but you know, you shoot a film well, you're there. It'll survive if you shoot a film as beautifully and as interestingly as you can. You know, it will transcend all the other badness that goes into it. And I think I'll probably say this again at the end when I wrap up, but I think Blade Runner is a huge example of that. Ultimately, Deckard's able to draw down on her and kills her. He has to shoot her multiple times, and after the first shot hits her, the actual sound design fades and the soundtrack comes up. And it's, you know, what's beautiful is that, you know, her death becomes a tragic thing. You know, she tried to kill him, right? And I think in a normal action movie, there'd be this sort of sense of triumphalism where he'd have a one-liner like, replicate this, bitch, you know. But he's not happy to have killed her, you know, when she's down and she doesn't look, you know, there's a really sad theme that comes on and she's on the ground with her eyes wide open, dead, and he's looking at her and he feels guilty about it. Like, he's not happy that he did it. And, you know, it's not a rock'em sock'em scene. And I think it's way to go, Ridley and the writer, for that one, because it took what started as a really cool looking scene and devolved into a really dumb scene and ended as a really sad sequence, you know. So Gaff intrudes upon all this because the cops are there, and he says, Bryant, Bryant, it's only one word. And Bryant's in a squad car nearby. And so what he tells Deckard is that Rachel has vanished, and he has to add one more kill to his list. And then, of course, Brian now knows that she's a replicant. And once Bryant and Gaff leave, Deckard sees Rachel from across the street. He's about to chase after her, but she vanishes. But then Leon appears, and he winds up beating the crap out of Deckard, really knocks him around, and he's about to kill him when Rachel, with some weapon, I don't know where she got it from, kills Leon from behind, saving his life. And at one point, right before Leon gets killed, he says to Deckard, who he's about to kill, wake up, time to die. And it's obviously a little echo of what we're going to hear at the last scene of the film. So the next sequence is Rachel and Deckard's love scene at Deckard's apartment. And again, you know, we're in the apartment. There's some wonderful lighting. It's all, you know, shadowed, and we get light coming in from outside. Just beautifully lit, beautifully lit. And Rachel has this wonderful line in this sequence. She has the shakes, and Deckard says, you know, the shakes are kind of part of the business, you know, of in terms of killing people. And she says, I'm not part of the business. I am the business. And she kind of puts out to Deckard, like, you know, she's like, I'm going to go north and, you know, go on the run. Would you come after me? And he's like, I wouldn't, but they would. Someone else would. And at this point, we get a little Harrison Ford beefcake as he removes his shirt, sort of cleans out his mouth and his head, because Leon kind of knocked him around pretty bad. Deckard basically falls asleep, and Rachel sits down at the piano, lets her hair down. She's looking at all of Deckard's photographs, and he's got all these old photographs on his piano. And you wonder if she's jealous, you know, at his memories, if they're real. So she takes her hair down, she starts playing the piano, and then he wakes up as she plays. And they have this one kiss, and then she tries to run out of the apartment, but he chases her, slams the door, doesn't allow her to leave, kind of corners her and basically repeats to her what she should say to him, like, tell me to kiss me, tell me to put your hands on me. It's a little rapey, you know? It's a little, there used to be some sort of license in film where men could kind of quasi-rape women, and, you know, the understanding was that they got into it, or no was yes, and all this bullshit that, you know, used to pass for gender relations. And obviously these days, thank God, it's been revealed as just quite a crock of crap. And so it's not so bad, and there's, you know, you get a sense that he, you know, she doesn't know how to deal with all these feelings that are coming up, so this is his way of helping her, you know, but it's a bit rapey. So now we're back at J.F. Sebastian's place, and Pris is putting on her raccoon eye makeup with an airbrush. I think they do it for real, which is kind of cool. And we see all of J.F. Sebastian's toys, all these different shapes and sizes of replicants that he's made. And we find out that JF has this degenerative disease where he's actually 25 years old, but he looks like he's closer to 40 or 50. And it's part of the theme, you know, that he's kind of has the same problem as his replicants do, wanting more life. And he also, there's this throwaway line where he says, where Pris asks him, how come you're still here on Earth? He says, I couldn't pass the medical. And we're getting another allusion to, you know, the best and brightest are gone from Earth, and what's left is what's left. So Roy Batty actually enters, because this has all been a ploy to get Roy to meet with JF and get him to gain access to Tyrell. And he and Pris kiss in this weird way that's kind of uncanny. Roy has this moment where he's telling Pris they're the only two left, that the other ones have been killed. He has this weird moment where he has to process his feelings for Leon and Zora. And obviously, you know, they're replicants, so they're not the best at this. They don't know really how to deal with feelings. And you got to give it to Howard. He does a really great uncanny. And it's only a moment. You know, like, this is only a moment that I don't think anyone would ever remember in this film. But it's a nice small touch that I really like. They kind of jokingly and not so jokingly threaten JF by saying, you got to send to see Tyrell. The gambit is that he plays chess with Tyrell. And they call each other. And they, you know, tell each other moves. And the other person moves. And so on and so forth. And the way they do it is the three of them go to the Tyrell Corporation, heading up to Tyrell's apartment. Batty is now making the moves for JF, and he winds up checkmating Tyrell. And Tyrell at that point is sitting up in bed dictating, you know, stock trading. And it's a really cool scene. It's, you know, it's filled with candles in his bedroom. It seems like Tyrell's used to beating Sebastian, and because of Batty is making the moves, he wins the game. And Tyrell's basically like, oh, you better come up, Sebastian. Let's talk about this. And it plays pretty well. It makes sense to me. I didn't find it that unbelievable that happened. So now you get this wonderful scene between Roy and Tyrell. You get this wonderfully arcane discussion of sort of biogenetics. I don't understand any of it, but man, it sounds really authentic, because Batty is asking Tyrell for more life, and Tyrell says, you know, we made you as well as we could. And so Roy is saying, have you tried recombinant DNA blank? And Tyrell's, yeah, we tried it, and this was the problem with that. Have you tried this? And the way they're talking back and forth to each other is, it just sounds like the real deal. And I wonder if one of the screenwriters went and sat with some geneticists and got this verbatim, and if all this is realistic. I should have to Google it to find out. But it sounds great in terms of verisimilitude in a film. And they do a great job. You know, at the end, basically, Terrell is like, there's nothing I can do for you, Roy. And there's a nice moment where Batty sort of drops his head and he confesses to Terrell. He's like, I've done terrible things, you know, Dad. And Terrell says, well, you know, you need to revel in your time. You know, you're extraordinary, Roy. And basically, Batty turns to him and crushes his head and puts his thumbs into his eye sockets and basically kills him and then kills Jareth Sebastian off screen. So now we're in our end game. Deckard has gotten the news of the Tyrell killings from Brian over the radio, and he's staking out the building where J.F. Sebastian lives. The cops have cleared the surrounding area, so he's the only one on the street. He enters the building, and again, we've got these wonderful lighting effects and deep shadows. Pris is waiting for him. And so Deckard enters Sebastian's apartment, and Pris is posed as one of his toys. It's very clever, you know, as we see Deckard walking around the scene. You know, we see who Pris is and where she's sitting, and he doesn't notice her right away. Once he sees her, then he kind of recognizes her, and he gets closer and closer, and he raises this odd wedding veil that she's wearing, and she knocks him down, hurts him pretty badly, you know, runs across the room and runs towards him, and it seems like she's going to deliver some killing blow. He finds his weapon, shoots her, and then the bullet goes in, and she goes down, but it triggers some weird reaction where she goes into like super speed and she's like, you know, slamming her arms and legs on the floor, like, you know, in fast motion. And it's really creepy. And there's a shriek. And so he has to shoot her like two more times. And it's a very uncanny, weird scene. And she dies. And so Roy finally returns from Terrell because Pris hadn't gone with him and Sebastian. The rain has begun. Roy finds Pris dead. And there's this weird scene where Pris's tongue is sticking out of her mouth. Roy kisses her, and then when he pulls away, the tongue kind of has gone. He's pushed it back in. Another weird little moment that's kind of cool, you know, but weird. Then we have this cat and mouse between Deckard and Batty. Batty's just, he's dying now. Like, he doesn't have long to live, and he's weird. He's playing with Deckard, and we hear a lot of him taunting Deckard from other rooms, and Deckard takes a shot at him and misses, and at one point, Deckard's got his arm and gun right against the wall, and Batty, from the other side of the wall, punches through it, grabs his gun hand, pulls it through. So Deckard's still on the other side of the wall, and he breaks two of his fingers. He says, that's for Pris, you know, that's for Zora, and puts the gun back in his hand, gives it to him. Deckard quickly fires when he gets it back and only grazes Batty. Then there's this weird howling that Batty's doing. He goes back to Pris's body and takes a bit of her blood and kind of puts it on himself as like war paint. He keeps calling like, Deckard! You know, he's calling Deckard's name, taunting him. He's pretty much taken off most of his clothing now. He's like in his skivvies. Deckard now is kind of afraid for his life, so he climbs up a wall and pokes through this wet, rotting plaster, and he's at the roof. Then he's on the roof of the building, and the rain's coming down in buckets. And then we intercut with the scene of Batty's hand curling because it's sort of his body's starting to shut down, and he takes this nail from a nearby piece of wood and jams it into his hand, somehow either keeping him awake or stimulating his pain receptors, which are keeping him going. Then they fight briefly with an iron pipe. Deckard hits Batty pretty badly. Batty grabs it, smashes Deckard, and Deckard's then out on a ledge in this impossibly tall building. Again, it's up so bloody high. Then Batty joins him at the window, taunting him, and Deckard's climbing up now, the side of the sort of building, trying to get to the roof. It's really weird because he has to climb something that's tilted outwards, and he makes it, and the roof is incredible. Like, the roof is filled with steam and these big pipes and tanks and puddles of rain and just detritus everywhere. Like, it's ruin porn, like, you know, on steroids. It's just so cool up there. So Deckard sees Batty, and in fear, he runs and leaps over to another roof, and he barely makes it. Like, he gets caught on this metal strut, and he's holding on, and he's pretty much not going to make it. And somehow Batty is holding a dove. I don't know where the hell he got the dove from. So he's holding a dove. He runs and clears the span, and suddenly appears over Deckard, and Deckard's about to fall. Batty grabs him by the wrist and pulls him up, and now they're both on the roof. And basically Deckard is incapacitated, and it's, you know, there's nothing you can really do at that moment. Then we get probably the most beautiful part of this movie, which is the end speech. Batty's about to die, and he's holding this dove, and Howard really nails it. Like, he's very powerful here, and I'll quote the brief speech because it's beautiful. And so he drops to his knees, and he's looking at Deckard, and he says, quote, I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea bees glitter in the dark at Tannhauser Gate. All those moments lost in time like tears in rain. Time to die. There's a slow-mo of Batty's head dropping down, and this dove flies away. And the whole dove thing, it's just goofy. I don't know what the hell the dove is doing there. I don't know. It's probably one of Sebastian's doves now that I think about it, but I don't know. It's weird. So Gaff arrives. He says the famous line, "You've done a man's job, sir." Walks away, and then he says this cryptic line to Deckard, "Too bad she won't live." But then again, who does? And so we get a sense that he knows about Rachel. So Deckard returns home. His door is open. He draws his gun, and he's saying Rachel's name. And after some suspense, we realize she's there, but she's just sleeping. They get themselves ready, and he tells Rachel, "We're going on the run. Do you trust me?" As they're leaving the apartment, Deckard sees one of Gaff's origami figures. And this one is a unicorn. Tells us two things. It tells us that Gaff's been to his apartment, knows that Rachel is there, is not going to tell Bryant, and is not going to pursue them. And the second piece of information, which is the one I dislike the most in this film, is the origami piece is the allusion to Deckard's memory of the unicorn, telling us that somehow Gaff has seen the files on Deckard and knows Deckard's dreams or knows Deckard's visions. And the only way that could be possible is the same way that Deckard knows the backstory for Rachel, in that Deckard himself is a replicant. And we fade to black. Now, before I review the, before I summarize, I really dislike the Deckard as a replicant. I really dislike it. I don't get it. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me that what is this film trying to do, right? I feel like it's a cheap twist ending that's thrown in there to, like, say, ooh, it's like the end of Inception when the top may or may not be wobbling. These cheap trick endings that are not necessary. Like, Deckard being a replicant or not being a replicant does nothing for me for the rest of the film. Doesn't reinforce any themes. It's like, well, who isn't a replicant? It's just this goofy notion like we could all be a replicant. What does it mean to be human? It's like we've already dealt with that theme. We've already dealt with it because Deckard's human and he has memories and Rachel has memories as well. As a viewer, you're comparing, are Rachel's memories any less real and important than Deckard's, even if Deckard's were, lived through as a child? What does it fucking matter in that moment today? You both have this sense of those memories making you who you are. Ghost in the Shell dealt with this a lot better where, in a sense, you are your memories, right? That's what makes you who you are. And whether they were programmed into you by someone or you lived through them, at that point, like in a sense, Rachel kind of has to say, maybe these are Tyrell's niece's memories, but they're mine too. And they're kind of, I don't know. It's a more interesting notion than like Deckard's a replicant too. Isn't that kooky? Like, I don't understand the purpose of that twist. And it didn't exist in the first film. I guess it was shot that way because the footage existed to be able to do it. I'm pretty ignorant. I mean, I would love anyone to email me or comment on the Facebook page like more about this Deckard being a replicant because I don't get it, and I don't think it needs to happen. So it kind of, when I see it now, it's like, it's such a beautiful film. I mean, frankly, at the end of the day, whatever. But it's just like, it's like a little like, see how clever we are? And I'm like, no. You don't earn that because this film is so colossally dumb in so many other areas. I don't think the film earns that myself. Summary of Blade Runner is, it's an interesting film in that the visuals, the pure, and to use the word sumptuous, I don't know how else to describe it. The sumptuousness of the visuals are astonishing. Frame after frame after frame after frame. There's not a bad looking shot in the entire movie. You can turn off the sound. Actually, it would be better if you could turn off the dialogue. But to watch this movie on pure visual terms is such a delight. So much craft and care has gone into what you're seeing up on screen. It's truly astonishing. And as well as the music and the sound design, all of the technical acumen used to make this movie is just as of the highest caliber. And, Ridley early in his career just made beautiful looking movies. The Duelist and Alien and Blade Runner. And in the mid to late 70s, movies just looked, for whatever reason, the way movies were shot at that time. The 80s, in some ways, movies kind of got less interesting looking in terms of the image itself. But there's so many beautiful movies made in the 70s where the image is king. And it's just, they made these wonderful anamorphic, deep focus films and just beautiful. But the movie is just dumb. The dialogue is terrible. There's so much of the dialogue concerned with the plot and the story is just some of the most abysmal stuff that you wouldn't put in, like, the, you know, the worst movie that you've seen. That said, you know, there are some really beautiful scenes that are very elegiac. I'm not sure how you pronounce that word, elegiac or whatever. But they have real pathos. You know, there's the killing of Zora, Batty's final scene. The scenes between Deckard and Rachel are all very touching and very, you know, very deep scenes. Like, they're powerful scenes. And they're stacked up next to, you know, these other scenes that are dumb or that are just really poorly written. So Blade Runner for me is a mess. Like, it's a beautiful film, and I think it will stand. It's how I come down, I think, at the end is that it's not a great film, but it is a great looking film. I can't put Blade Runner in the pantheon. I mean, it's already in the pantheon, so no one really gives a shit what I think. But it's so flawed in terms of story and, you know, a lot of other things that, you know, not fatally, but enough to where it's a mess, you know. But there's, so, I mean, frame for frame, it's one of the most beautiful films ever done, I think. I mean, I can't look at a frame of this movie and find a flaw in it, you know. But it's better than the material in that way. Actually, not better than the material. It's why people keep coming back to this movie, you know, and I think some of the final scene with Batty. The concepts are great, you know, in the terms of memory and identity and a replicant versus a human being, pretty amazing concepts, again, in a really great sci-fi way, very heady, and they lend weight to the deep scenes in the movie, like the sci-fi concept of giving a construct memories adds weight to the scenes between Rachel and Deckard, you know, and same with Batty, you know, when Roy dies, like, he realizes he's losing everything, and it's because of the concept of the film, you know, so it's unified in that way. So, you know, Blade Runner, just for me, a very frustrating film. There's so much about it that's really good. There's extremely glaring problems that cannot be brushed under the rug. So, you know, I come down on it for myself as just, you know, it's a beautiful film with a lot of problems. That's Blade Runner. And the actual Blade Runner film kicked off a small franchise, not Dick's novel. There's an author by the name of K.W. Jeter. Like Derek Jeter, who wrote three sequels to the movie, novels called Blade Runner 2, The Edge of Human in 1995, Blade Runner 3, Replicant Night in 1996, and Blade Runner 4, Eye and Talon in 2000. In 1999, a guy by the name of Stuart Hazeldine had written a sequel script to Blade Runner based on one of those books titled Blade Runner Down. The project was shelved due to rights issues, so who knows what that's about. But as of this recording in February of 2015, there is Blade Runner 2 in development. Scott originally was going to direct. He will no longer direct. He may produce now. Ford will not be in it except possibly as like a third act. He will show up. It was, I think later in 2014, there was more scuttlebutt that it was really going to be a fast track and Scott was in it. But from what I've read since then, they haven't really broken the story. So it's kind of in development hell. But it's around. So in the next 3 or 4 years, it may be possible for us to be seeing a sequel to Blade Runner. We shall see. And that ends this episode of Sci-Fi on Screen, Blade Runner. Hope you enjoyed it. You can find us online at scifionscreen.com or on Facebook, and you can search for us in any podcast app on any smartphone, and we're also available on iTunes. Had fun talking about Blade Runner. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you next time.